Welcome to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. We introduce you to the voices of community thought leaders and change makers who are working on solutions that face our fellow individual community members, neighborhoods, cities, and our region. This is George Koster, your host. This episode is part of our series exploring COVID-19's impact on nonprofits and small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area. Back in April of 2020, when we decided to create this ongoing series on COVID-19's impact, first on nonprofits and then on small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area, we, like you, had no idea how long the pandemic would go on and what the health and economic impact would be in our community. As we enter the second half of 2022 with the latest explosion of cases from the most recent COVID-19 Omicron mutations, along with the masking requirements being changed and folks getting their vaccinations, our communities are still struggling to deal with the health, economic, mental, and societal impacts of the ongoing global pandemic. This all adds to the ongoing uncertainty of our ever-changing indoor and outdoor, vaccinated and unvaccinated protocols, and the politics of the pandemic that will drive how we all come back together as a unified or fractured community. We will continue to shine a spotlight on the nonprofits and small businesses that make up the fabric of our community, along with the founders and staff who are struggling to deal with the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on their operations, services, and sustainability until we can all get to the other side of the pandemic. Along the way, we will also share with you all the amazing solutions that our nonprofits, small businesses, foundations, and government leaders are working on to help us all get to the other side of the pandemic and come together to rebuild our communities with more economic, social, and environmental equality.
So if theaters allow themselves to make this shift and realize that they have to be a composite, they have to be both live and have a significant online presence, not just a website, then I think it will allow theater to flourish more.
In this episode, we are following back up with the San Francisco Mime Troupe, who we interviewed 2 years ago when we launched this special series on COVID-19's impact on nonprofits. Back in June of 2020, with the beginning of the pandemic, Michael Gene Sullivan shared with us that the San Francisco Mime Troupe was canceling its annual summer live show performances in public parks and focusing their work to create and launch a series of radio plays, which are being aired on KSFP. Michael also participated in our virtual live group discussion with 6 performing arts organizations about the production of live shows. This was in episode 83 in September of 2021, when the COVID-19 Delta variant was waning and the hope was to bring back live performances. Sadly, we all know what happened with the wave of Omicron and its impact on our performing arts organizations and communities. Join us now as we check back in with Michael and Alicia to tell us about the new musical show, Back to the Way Things Were, and bringing back live performances at our public parks. I'm joined remotely by Michael Gene Sullivan, an award-winning writer, performer, and director, along with Alicia M.P. Nelson, an award-winning actor, clown, and arts educator. Michael and Alicia are collective members of the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Welcome to Voices of the Community, Alicia and Michael.
Hi, how's it going? Though I should say that Alicia is not a collective member with the troupe. She's in the cast of the upcoming show, but she's not a collective
member. There we go. So I guess she has to get a Mime Troupe merit badge of some sort to then become a member of the collective.
She'll get a free t-shirt.
There you go. Everyone needs one of those. So, Michael, how has COVID-19 changed the San Francisco Mime Troupe's performances in this past 2 years since we first spoke in June of 2020 with the beginning of things like radio plays like Tales of the Resistance and then your co-production with SF Playhouse in the fall of 2021, The Great Con, and of course, now coming back into live productions?
Well, when COVID hit, you know, the first time, and we were just gearing up for our summer show, we were so excited, didn't know what it was going to be yet, but I was like thinking about it and trying to figure out what to write. And when suddenly everything got shut down and then we had to start trying to reschedule, it's like, well, maybe we'll open late. Maybe we'll only do some shows. Maybe we'll only play at certain places. And then finally we were like, we cannot risk our audience because a lot of theaters were like, well, we want to try to keep trying to do something. We can check at the door and stuff like that. And we were like, we can't check anybody at the door. It's just in the park. And we'd be requiring an audience to show up. So we decided to do radio plays, which I've always been a huge fan of. And so, and it was so much fun to write and to do them. It allowed us to work with a lot of actors we hadn't worked with before, people around the country, to be able to really do that thing that radio / scripted podcasts do, which is to create the play in the listener's mind. And then that fall, we decided early, let's just do Tales of the Resistance too. And while that was happening, I had been writing this other show, The Great Con, just as a challenge to myself. But San Diego Rep picked it up, and then San Francisco Playhouse picked it up. And so while we were doing Tales of the Resistance 2, we were rehearsing The Great Con with SF Playhouse, which was done as a co-production with the Mime Troupe. And we haven't done co-productions in a long time. But actually, it was SF Playhouse's idea. And they were like, you want to do a co-pro? And I was like, that'd be great. So that was really a great experience for us. And then this year deciding, okay, we feel like enough people are vaccinated, enough people are boosted, enough people have, we have our cards, we have our sanitizing stuff, we can go back into the parks, finally. But it has been really difficult because we, as a theater company that does free plays, we rely on some private foundations, government money, and donations from the audience. And if we're not doing park shows, we can't go out there and ask them to give us their hard-earned money. Unlike, you know, most theaters that you buy the ticket ahead of time, and then you go, that show sucked. With us, you could say it right to us because we're right there and we'll still ask you for money. And so we're hoping that everybody will come out this year to see the park show and get back into the habit of, again, giving us all their hard-earned money so that we can use it to help overthrow capitalism, power to the people, and all of that.
Wonderful. All right. So that brings us up to where we are, which is the new musical Back to the Way Things Were. And you guys are coming back and touring at the public parks, including what you used to always do every 4th of July, a weekend in San Francisco at Dolores Park. You're going to be back. So tell the audience about the new musical, Back to the Way Things Were, kind of what was the genesis behind it and overarching story.
Well, when we did our second summer of radio scripted podcasts, the final show in the series, because the first year it was four different storylines that all wove together and came to an ending right at the end. And the last episode was when Trump lost the election and refused to accept it. Who saw that coming? And then
everybody.
Yeah, everybody. But it was weird when I was writing it, people were like, oh, that's not going to happen. And I was like, it's absolutely, because I had to write it before the election. I had to write it before it actually happened. And so I had to pick how that was going to happen. And so, oh, well, anyway, I wish I'd been wrong. And so last year with Persistence, the final show was a half hour show called Back to the Way Things Were, which Daniel Savio, our composer lyricist, and I wrote as a short musical to deal with people who are thinking, well, that now that, oh, COVID is relenting, Trump, we don't have just a criminal con man idiot in the White House. We can go back to the good old days. And so a lot of people, liberal folk, are thinking, well, now we can get back to the good old days. And it's like, well, the good old days kind of sucked. I mean, the Trump administration and this reactionary phase we're in has simply heightened problems that were already there. And so to remind people, on the one hand, of how bad things were. And so what I decided to do was tell the story of three people. Basically, it's a family, husband and wife, Ralph and Alice, for those who would remember those names, Ralph and Alice, who just want to, all they want to do is have a date night and go back to the way things were, but when they could just go out and not have to wear masks and all that stuff. And then they have a daughter, Zoe, who Alicia plays, who she remembers the old days much differently than they do. She grew up through the war on terror. She grew up through, there's a line in the play where she says she's never been able to get on an airplane without taking off her shoes first. And because I wanted to get into what this generation that's grown up in the last 22 years has had to deal with. It's one thing to get on an airplane and go, oh, we might crash, and you have to have some distance from that. But what about thinking every time you get on a plane, you have to do this extra little thing because someone might want to kill you. You grow up with the idea of being a murder victim in your head. That's completely different. Or doing, having to deal with school shootings, having to go to school and having to train yourself on what to do if somebody comes in because they want to murder you. What kind of future is this? So these two different versions of people either giving up because they see no future, or people who are giving up on trying to do things because they think that now that we've had an administrative change, their work is kind of done and they're exhausted from 4 years of protesting. So musical comedy. So that's that was where the idea came from. And so expanding that, and Daniel's been writing all of these great songs for it. And Valina Brown, who's a longtime mime troupe actor, is directing this show. This is her first park show directing. And we brought in new people like Alicia to be in the show.
Wonderful. And that's a great segue to you, Alicia. So, gosh, I hear so many really good laughs in the complete catastrophe that Michael just described for us. So, Alicia, share with the audience a little bit about your background. Is this your first mime troupe production?
It is my first mime troupe production, but it is not my first experience with the mime troupe. So I am a Bay Area baby, born and raised. I grew up in San Jose. I've been an artist pretty much since being in the womb. My mom runs a social justice theater company, so I pretty much spent my whole life watching and sometimes participating and seeing how the arts and using one's imagination can be healing and can challenge perspectives. And my mom used to take me to see mime troupe shows when I was a kid. So I remember seeing Michael and Valina on the stage and I getting my mime troupe t-shirt and feeling like I've got the coolest swag and like going out to school and everyone's like, what is this? And I was like, oh, this is my mime troupe shirt. This place is so cool. You would not believe it. So being able to do a mime troupe show now is a very cool like, full circle moment.
And so from wearing your t-shirt, how did you get engaged in and working with the mime troupe and becoming Zoe?
Yeah, I mean, Michael said he was looking for a 20-something-year-old, and I was like, hi, I'm a 20-something-year-old. And then the pieces kind of fell into place, and it all just worked out perfectly just from one conversation. Michael said, can you be someone who's a little hopeless? And I was like, I think I fit the bill. So yeah, it was just a wonderful little moment of kismet, just like, up, just right where I needed to be at the right time.
Well, so then tell us about Zoe and her importance to the story itself and saving the world as we know it.
Yeah. So like Michael said, Zoe is feeling pretty down. She's like early 20s and her version of the world has never been peaches and cream. There was 9/11. There have been economic crashes. There have been systemic murdering of Black people. There's school shootings. There's everything. So she is grappling with how to be an adult or starting to be an adult in a world in which she feels like there's not really a space for her to imagine a future. Her parents are saying, go get an internship, work so you can get work experience, do these things. And Zoe's like, but if everything is falling apart, then what is the point of me actually doing all these steps that to you were super important, but to me, I'm watching people fight over whether or not women have control over their own bodies and how is an internship important right now. And so she's not completely hopeless, I don't think, but starting to get there and everything is just really hard. And right before she was going to go to experience adult life and go to school, a pandemic started and then she was stuck in an apartment with her parents and their worldview that just completely clashed with theirs. So she's having a hard time. And then she meets someone who challenges that perspective a little bit, and that's all I'm gonna say about that.
and is that your crazy conspiracy friend?
Yes, but I'm not gonna spoil it.
You're listening to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. Voices of the Community is supported by a grant from the James Irvine Foundation, dedicated to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. More at irvine.org. This is George Koster, your host, and if you're just joining us, in this episode, we're discussing how the COVID-19 pandemic continues to impact our performing arts organizations in our communities and their efforts to bring back live performances. Let's get back to our conversation with Michael Jean Sullivan and Alicia M.P. Nelson from the San Francisco Mime Troupe about their new musical, Back to the Way Things Were.
Right, and that's played by Andre, and Andre's...
No. It's not. The conspiracy realist is Keiko Shimasato Carrero, longtime mime troupe writer, director, actor. Andre plays so many people in the show. When I was writing it, and I was like, I started finding these different things. Like, I need this character. These people are off. And then I decided to just go ahead and make it a thing that Andre plays all of these different people, from the richest person in the show to a homeless fellow who's lost everything to a kid who works at a McBurger in the Box versus a climate change activist. He's just bouncing through all of these different roles, to a racist police officer, to all of these different characters.
Yeah, I don't think he has enough to do.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Oh, and a news reporter at some point.
Too. Right. And this is Andre Amorodico, who was in, who's part of the troupe. And last year I was in the two radio plays, as I recall, right?
Both. Yes, done a few shows for us. He was in Treasure Island. Oh, and he was in Seeing Red. So he's worked with us, I think, you know, for a few years now. I mean, he's great. He's a lot of fun. Wonderful actor. Great singing voice.
Well, and so staying with you, can you share with the audience one of your favorite stories of, I would say two stories. First, working with the troupe, and then second, a story, a favorite story about being Zoe.
I think my favorite part or my favorite thing about being Zoe, which has been like a continuing thing throughout the rehearsals, is she's very sarcastic and sardonic. And I'm loving finding the different ways that I can do that. And my favorite thing is when I get a giggle out of someone who's in the cast, who's heard this line a million times already. And I say it just a little differently and they laugh and I go, oh, yes. Or if I can get Keiko to laugh, even when we're rehearsing, then I know, made or break character. I know that I did something that might be interesting to our audiences too, which is super fun. Favorite mime troupe experience in this rehearsal? We just have fun. Right when we were table talking this show, we were just sitting around and talking about these characters and the world they live in. And just we somehow end up going on the wildest tangents and start talking about can-can dancers. And we imagine, what if Andre had a can-can dancing character? And seeing how we can all talk so comfortably with each other, I think is the best part.
It's wonderful. And then, Michael, circling back to you for a moment, how can people who are listening to the show and the general public support the Mime Troupe? So you're back doing live shows, and you were mentioning earlier in our conversation about how COVID-19's really impacted the troupe's ability to reach out to the audience and for audience members to support you in person, or to either say they love or hate the shows in real time. So share with the audience a little bit, how can folks support you and support the live shows, as well as, I don't think a lot of people understand, the Mime Troupe does a lot of different programming throughout the year that you also need funding for. And then, are you guys looking for volunteers for this coming summer?
Oh, let's start with that last point. We are definitely looking for volunteers. The things that the people don't know, like you were saying about the Mime Troupe, that we have all of these other programs. Our summer show is the big thing we do, but we also have like this whole educational wing of the Young California Writers Project, the Don Stevens Young California Writers Project. And so they gave us all of this money to support our comedy writing, which is just really wonderful of them. And so we use that money to go teach playwriting, political playwriting, political comedy playwriting in schools. We have a young theater program where we bring students into the Mime Troupe and we actually pay them to come. We pay them to be there to study with us, and we feed them and we teach them how to create plays as kind of collectively, as opposed to the playwrights thing, which is more individual playwrights. We have summer workshops, which are free. People come from around the world to study with us. And we have internships. But it's been very difficult because of all the restrictions. And so we definitely need people to help us, because people come see a Mime Troupe show and they're like, oh, that's great. They're in the park. We get there at like 9:30 in the morning and build the set, do sound check, do costumes, do all of that stuff, have lunch, do the show, go out, ask them for money and support, go back, take the set down, and put it back in the truck. So our work day is like an 8-hour day, sometimes 9, 8-hour day of manual labor, in which the show is this little part. And so having people to help us at every park is a huge, huge benefit, just to help us carry things around. And people can go to our website, sfmt.org, and find out more about the company, find out about individuals and our history. And if they feel so moved to make a donation, that would be nice. And one of the biggest things that people can do is really, if you come and see a show early in the season and you like it, tell everybody you know. If you like the show, tell your friends. If you don't like the show, tell your enemies, so that we can get as big a crowd as possible each time.
Well, and the tour, also going back to the website, if folks show up at the website, there's an entire list of the tour itself, which starts on July 2nd, right? As I recall, mm-hmm. and goes all the way through to September 20th.
Labor Day,
right. And you guys are going to kick off opening days in Dolores Park on July 4th?
Yeah, I mean, the first two shows are shows. And we do Dolores. It's just because we're traditionally, it's 4th of July, the most patriotic day. And what can say more patriotism than coming and watching a bunch of leftists with a big red star talk about freedom and justice and the future and hope?
Well, and the first two shows are at the Cedar Rose Park in Berkeley. That's July 2nd and 3rd. That's Saturday and Sunday. So I'm going to circle back here just for a moment, because I want any young playwrights or their parents thereof, if they are interested in applying to be your intern for the summer, what would they do?
They could just email me at michaelsullivan@sfmt.org.
All right, going to start with you, Zoe, for aka Alicia, for our final question that I've been asking of everyone for the last couple of years. Here we are going into year 2+ with a global pandemic that's still going. What do you feel are some of the positive things that have come out or could come out of the pandemic that could help support the performing arts?
The first thing, I think slowing down was a very positive thing. Of course, not slowing down to a grinding halt and then going bankrupt. We don't want that for theater companies. But being able to actually stop and reevaluate, I think, is a blessing for a lot of companies and a lot of artists. Before the pandemic, I was working so hard. I was not sleeping. I was auditioning every chance I could get. And then I just couldn't. And I was able to stop and think and go, okay, what do I actually want? I think that's a gift that was given to me, at least, and being able to breathe, think, look. And also, I think it's challenged a lot of accessibility for theaters. It's made everyone pivot and find a new way to work. And previously, it was just in person. You come and you see the show. And now it's, are you making videos? How do you make that accessible? We got to include open captions. We're going to have translators. So I think it's broadened some horizons. And now we just have to figure out how to still do that while also sort of going back to the way things were.
Love it. And staying with you, Zoe, for a second. So for folks who are listening, et cetera, you're an art educator. Where else can folks find out more about your art education services, all the other work you're doing outside of the Mime Troupe?
So primarily my art education work is with the Red Ladder Theater. So we have a website, redladder.org. You can find out a lot of information there. If you want my personal information, I do like private coaching for kids and dance. And my general acting website is my initials, ampnelson.com.
Great. Thank you. And then Michael, coming back to you for the final question. So what are some of the good things that have come out or could come out of the pandemic to support? And I think the remaking, kind of rebuilding of our arts and cultural economy.
Well, I think that Alicia touched on most of it. I think that the idea of, as strange as it is, people being at home actually brought the acting community together in a really interesting way, because you could suddenly work with actors around the country, people that you hadn't seen, people overseas, people everywhere that you'd been separated with from geographically. Suddenly it was like, oh, I could just do a Zoom call. Oh, I could just do a FaceTime and be able to do readings with them. So having that, I think it reminded a lot of performers how much we are a community, despite the fact that we're separated by space, but we're not separated by time. So that was a great thing. And also the idea of different ways to get the word out. So during the first summer, when Mime Troupe was doing Tales of the Resistance, we had a show. And so we had videoed that show back in whatever, 2015, when we did it. And we had this video and we got in touch with Actors Equity and said, can we put this online? Since we can't do a summer show, would it be all right for us to put this on? And Equity has always had a lot of rules protecting the images of the actors. They don't want producers to take advantage of that. But since we are a self-producing group of actors, essentially, they were like, we think that'll be okay. And what ended up happening from our negotiations with Equity, they asked us, what are other ways we should approach other theater companies? And we said, you've got to start letting companies put stuff online. And we really pushed that. We need a new contract. We need all of this. And so now Equity is allowing, because traditionally, if you did a show, you got one video of the show as an archival video, one camera, no panning, no close-ups. After we did Freedom Land and it was a multi-camera shoot, Equity said, we're going to start letting all of these companies do multi-camera shoots to make them look good, which means that when my adaptation of 1984, which got filmed because of COVID, it got seen in like New Zealand. It was being run in Houston, but it got a review from New York. People around the world could see it. So if theaters allow themselves to make this shift and realize that they have to be a composite, they have to be both live and have a significant online presence, not just a website, that I think it will allow theater to flourish more.
And so really, in a sense, changing the business model and opening that fourth wall that was always there, right?
Yeah.
But now the fourth wall being a Zoom, so someone from anywhere in the world can watch a live show.
Yeah. And I think that, like I said, it puts more pressure on the theaters to make sure that the work that they're doing really speaks to people. Because if you're doing Oklahoma and a bunch of companies around the country are doing Oklahoma, why should they watch yours? But if you decide to do a show by a local playwright, that's a new play that's dealing with a very specific issue and nobody else is doing it, maybe that's the show you film that season. If you only do one, you do the one that's going to be unique and interesting and bold and innovative. And I think that it will allow the audiences a chance to see the world through a multiplicity of visions rather than just another Romeo and Juliet. And that's another place where the internet can be a great boon.
It's great. Wonderful insights. Thank you, Michael and Alicia, for sharing your work today, along with the San Francisco Mime Troupe's coming back with their latest show, Back to the Way Things Were. We'll make sure that listeners have your contact information, website, and social media so they can participate in one of the free live shows in parks during the summer tour running from July 2nd to September 5th at public parks in San Francisco Bay Area, Davis, and Santa Cruz. Please stay safe and healthy as we all work our way through this new pseudo-normalcy, or as you both would like to say, getting back to the way things were. That's it for this episode of Voices of the Community. You've been listening to the voices of Michael Gene Sullivan and Alicia M.P. Nelson of the San Francisco Mime Troupe about bringing back live performances in public parks and their new musical show, Back to the Way Things Were. You can become a volunteer, find out about the summer tour dates and public park locations, along with making a donation to support the work of the San Francisco Mime Troupe by going to their website, sfmt.org. To get more history and background into the San Francisco Mime Troupe, please listen back to Episode 4 and to learn about how performing arts organizations have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic and how they're struggling to bring back live performances. Please listen back to Episode 83 to hear from City Arts and Lectures, San Francisco Performances, the San Francisco War Memorial and Performing Arts Center, and music at Cole Mansion. And to get even more background about all the amazing work that our performing arts organizations and other nonprofits are doing to support our communities, please go to georgecoster.com and click on Voices of the Community to listen back to all the wonderful stories from our past guests. We hope that you enjoyed the insights, points of view, and personal stories from the voices of changemakers and their nonprofits and small businesses featured in this series. To find out more and get engaged with the nonprofits, small businesses, and staff members featured in the series, please go to my website, georgecoster.com, and click on Voices of the Community to find links to the extended versions of these interviews and to listen to the entire series. After listening to these stories, we hope that you will consider making a donation and volunteering to provide a hand up to your fellow community members. Today's episode was made possible by the audio wizard and our associate producer, Eric Estrada, and the graphics magic of Casey Nance from Citron Studios, along with the wonderful crew at the San Francisco Public Press and KSFP. Voices of the Community is supported by a grant from the James Irvine Foundation, dedicated to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. More at irvine.org. Voices of the Community is a member of Intersection for the Arts, which allows us to offer you a tax deduction for your contributions. Please go to georgecoster.com and click on the donate link to make a donation to help us provide future shows just like this one. While you're on our website, you can enjoy our archived past shows, which feature community voices working on solutions to critical issues facing Northern California communities. And you can sign up for our newsletter to find out more about future shows, as well as shows and events from the organizations that are included in our episodes. Take us along on your next COVID walk by subscribing to Voices of the Community on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and Google Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, at George Coster, and we'd love to hear from you with feedback and show ideas, so send us an email to george@georgecoster.com. I'm George Coster in San Francisco, and thank you for listening.